There is something remarkable about the generation that founded this nation. They led a daring revolution against the strongest military power in the world, declared their independence based on self-evident truths, asserted a new ground for political rule and popular consent, and launched an experiment in self-government. They created an enduring framework of liberty that allows us to enjoy the blessings of that liberty. Yet for all their wisdom and accomplishments, they could not guarantee the success of their project. That, they knew, depended not on the precision of the laws, the strength of the economy, or the extent of military power, but on the character of citizens. Now, of course, law plays a significant role in the shaping of civic character, as it influences and reflects habits and mores. Government must take into account man's self-interest. But the founders did design laws, others to the contrary notwithstanding, that would encourage certain virtues and habits. They did not believe that institutional arrangements, however, were sufficient to define and maintain the type of character necessary for republican government. A well-constructed constitution did not remove but amplify the need for good citizens. Thus our concern about citizen formation. Like moral character generally, civic formation begins early, not with the intellect, but with the imagination. It starts and is done primarily through the presentation and then the emulation of models of good character and civic virtue, first in stories, then in books, then in biographies. Every child in America should be acquainted with his own history, wrote Noah Webster. As soon as he opens his lips, he should lisp the praise of liberty and those illustrious heroes and statesmen who have wrought a revolution in her favor. The objective of such an education, he continued, is to implant in the minds of the American youth the principles of virtue and liberty and inspire them with just and liberal ideas of government and an attachment to their own country. Another element of civic formation, building on the first, is more strictly intellectual. Republican government requires a certain degree of civic literacy about rights and responsibilities, not to mention the workings and structural requirements of free government. Citizens must know that legitimate government is grounded on the recognition of equal natural rights and derives just powers from the consent of the governed. They must be aware of the threats to those rights. They must have some knowledge of and appreciate how the Constitution limits government and works to protect liberty. Together, history and civic knowledge would foster attachment, and attachment, patriotism. Illustrious examples are displayed to our view that we may imitate as well as admire, James Wilson wrote in his student textbook. Before we can be distinguished by the same honors, we must be distinguished by the same virtues. What are those virtues? They are chiefly the same virtues, which have already been seen to be descriptive of the American character, especially the love of liberty and a love of law. But he reminds us, law and liberty cannot rationally become the objects of our love unless they first become objects of our knowledge. From Webster's textbooks to McGuffey's readers, this notion of citizenship, combining moral character and civic knowledge, was the primary purpose of early public education. Undergirding the whole was civil society. The traditional associations of civil society, families, schools, churches, voluntary organizations, sustained social order and public morality, moderated individualism and restrained the passions, cultivated character and virtue. Republican government is only possible if the private virtues needed for self-government were strong. These institutions must be healthy and flourishing. So, what happened? This worldview of the American founders was attacked, root and branch, by progressivism, which is itself the seed of modern liberalism. The Constitution was alleged to be a reactionary document designed to thwart democratic principles and opinion. They wanted to make it a living document, capable of change, growth, adaptation. But they further argued that such an unprecedented situation, the Industrial Revolution, required nothing less than a new relationship between citizens and the federal government that emphasized a public spirited devotion to a collective ideal, what John Dewey called the great community, and Lyndon Johnson later proclaimed the Great Society. The philosophical heart of this transformation was the establishment of relativism as the new coin of the realm, and that gutted what had existed theretofore. Consider how this has changed how we speak about citizenship. American history, in particular, the ideas and institutions of the American founders, is seen as outdated, oppressive, if not meaningless, to use Carl Becker's term, a barrier to historical change and social progress. Culture, no culture is superior or inferior. Rather than exceptionalism, we speak of multiculturalism. Rather than civic virtues, we speak of civic values, which imply that none is judged to be worth more than the other, though we seem to favor the soft values, toleration, empathy, compassion. Civics is not a form of knowledge based on content, but an adaptive set of skills, not to maintain the old constitution, but to advance political change. And the sentimentality of patriotism is replaced by cosmopolitanism. Patriotism implies a false air of moral weight and glory, writes one scholar. Rather than developing preferences for one nation, students must be taught that they are citizens of the world. These ideas, developed by progressive intellectuals, are today articulated, defended, and advocated by the leading lights of the modern American Academy. These ideas, I believe, threaten the future of the Republic. There is much interest today, from President Bush on down, in reviving history and civics. But there is also a well-established history and civics movement that is dominated by the intellectual left. Any revival must first and foremost be a criticism of the leading colleges and universities, and must entail the cultivation of scholars and the establishment of new programs and institutions that adhere to older ideas. Our challenge today is not that our students do not know the important facts of history, but they don't care. Students will not believe that those facts and that history are worth learning as long as their teachers believe it is not worth teaching. Students cannot be expected to learn about rights and responsibilities if they are taught that there is no right and wrong. Discussing the revival of civics and the encouragement of history without challenging the relativism and historicism at the heart of the academic establishment is, in the long run, in my view, a losing proposition. Merely creating a new flavor in the value-free smorgasbord of modern education. Steve has already referred to Benjamin Franklin's famous phrase, "A republic, if you can keep it." The type of education needed to keep our republic will best be done, unfortunately, if teachers today ignore virtually everything that passes as higher learning in America. We must tell the truth of our history, of our great institutions and traditions. We must tell the stories of our statesmen and our heroes, striking what Lincoln called the mystic chords of our memory. But we must remember that the purpose is not merely to transfer knowledge and information, but to inculcate in our citizens, especially our young citizens, an enlightened love of country, rekindling what Washington called the sacred fire of liberty. Therein, I believe, lies the future of our republic. Thank you.